Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 127, Buddhism 101, The Six Realms.
So I'm going to talk about the six realms. In Tibetan cosmology, you know, this realm where we are, which is the human realm, is only one of six places, six realms that beings, sentient beings, can live their lives. So we're not going to spend the whole weekend talking about reincarnation, although we have in the past. But it's a fundamental tenet of...
We always will.
It's a fundamental tenet of Bob's take on Buddhism and many other people's takes on Buddhism, that this life is but one of many, and that we will, depending on our the state of our minds in this life, that will determine where we go next. And it, the traditional cosmology... There are six realms, the human realm being one, the animal realm being another, hell realm, of which there are many, hell realms being another. There's a wonderful realm of the hungry ghosts, or the pretas, which we'll talk about, which is not quite a human realm, not quite a hell realm. It's its own place, full of beings that are filled with inexhaustible longing. But they can't take in any nourishment. That relates to addiction. There's a realm of the jealous gods, and then there's a god realm. So one of the ways that I have liked to think about this cosmology is not just as a description of places that we might go after we die, but that it's a description of states of mind that we're all passing through in this very life, and that you know, we're all not just capable, but we're all sort of mercilessly being cycled through these various realms. And the way it's depicted, we don't have a tanka of it here, but the way it's depicted is very interesting. It's called the Wheel of Life. But the Wheel of Life is set into the yawning jaws of Yama, the Lord of Death. So the Wheel of Life is held by death, indicating, you know, that a fundamental principle, which is that everything is temporary. Okay, so the six realms are in a circle. It's a mandala, held by in the jaws of death. There's a ladder, like in chutes and ladders, there's a ladder coming off of the human realm, which signifies the way to nirvana, the way to enlightenment, the way to awakening. And it comes out of the human realm, because the human realm where we all are is the best place to achieve enlightenment from, because it has the perfect balance of joy and suffering. The other realms are weighted in other directions, but the suffering itself that has brought most of us here today, that we're talking about under the rubric of anxiety, depression, and addiction. One of the beautiful things about this model is that the causes of suffering, which are depicted in each of the realms, the causes of suffering are also the means of release. So the thing that we have control over, which is the mind training aspect of meditation, the thing that we have control over is our perspective on our own suffering. And when we're in our normal self-preoccupied states, we look at it one way. And as we start to train the mind, which Buddhism is very good at, the instructions are very specific, and tomorrow especially we'll get into a lot of it. But as you start to train the mind, it becomes possible to shift the perspective on this very experience that we're all having. So the question over here about do we have to get better or do we just have to accommodate ourselves, not necessarily in a stoic way, but do we have to accommodate ourselves to the experience that we're actually having in this mind and this body? That becomes the question. So I've been on a number of silent Vipassana retreats. That's the Buddhist tradition that I practice the most comes out of what's called Theravada Buddhism, which is the Buddhism that's still practiced in Burma and Thailand and Sri Lanka for the most part. The way it's been transplanted into the West are in these silent 10-day, 2-week, week-long, month-long, 3-month-long retreats where everything is slowed down and you try to bring mindful awareness to your sitting, your walking, your eating, etc. There's no talking and no reading, and you're just meant to use your own experience as the fodder for your awakening. I always smuggle a little notebook into those retreats just in case I get a good idea that I might forget, or I hear a teaching that's goes to the heart of something that I'm struggling with. Every 10 years or so, I'll open up the notebook when I'm feeling stuck in my writing or in my life to see if one of those little things that I wrote down might help. And what I discovered after 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, is that I keep writing down different versions of the same thing. Because every time I hear it, it seems so profound, and it's like I've never heard it before. But it's usually some version of, it's not what you're experiencing that matters, it's how you relate to it. And if there's one thing to take away from everything that I'm going to talk about all weekend, it's going to be that. It's not what you're experiencing that matters, because you really can't control what you're experiencing so much. We're cycling through these realms. Sometimes we're having joyful, godlike experiences. Sometimes we're tortured by anxiety or burning with rage, like in the hell realms. We really can't control what comes up, but we can control how we relate to it, and that's what we're going to be practicing together. So in the center of the mandala are three animals, a pig, a snake, and a rooster, and they're circling each other, the tail of one in the mouth of another. Do any of you know what they represent, the pig, the snake, and the rooster?
Attachment, aversion, and ignorance.
Attachment, aversion, and ignorance, right. Or greed, hatred, and delusion would be another way. The pig is usually ignorance, I think. The snake would be anger. And the rooster would be greed or lust or attachment, clinging. So they're going in a circle at the center of the mandala. They're driving the whole thing. The ladder is going off the human realm to signify that there is release. But the higher teachings, the Mahayana Vajrayana teachings that we'll be hearing more from when I let Bob start to talk, the fundamental principle there is that samsara, this is the wheel of samsara, the wheel of suffering, the wheel of life, samsara is nirvana. Nirvana is samsara. In the elementary teachings, the preliminary teachings, the teachings for like young people, then they teach that nirvana is like away from samsara. That if you work to train your mind and conquer your mind and calm your addictions and make your anxiety dissolve, and when you're not depressed anymore and you get enlightened, then you get to leave the wheel and go to some poorly described transcendental place where nothing happens, which is one view of nirvana. But commitment on this weekend is to disabuse any of you who might be thinking about nirvana in that way. Unless you need to. If you need to think about it that way and that's helpful, it's fine. But it's much more interesting and I think much more profound to imagine this world, this life, this mind, this body, that, you know, this very imperfect one that you feel stuck in, as already nirvana, as already enlightened, as, you know, but we can't see it because we're stuck in some way. You know, stuck in addiction, maybe, stuck in depression, maybe, stuck in anxiety, maybe, or just stuck in self-referential thinking, which we would say would underlie all of those states. So,
are you now departing into the Mahayana?
You know that I have long ago departed into the Mahayana.
Burma will be deeply
distressed. No. My experience of the most awakened of the Theravada teachers is that they don't dispute any of this. They understand it already inside of them. They have to keep quiet for the sake of...
Okay,
so anyway. So I just want to go through, it's interesting to pay a little bit of attention to each realm. I won't fill the space up totally, but if you reflect a little bit while I'm talking on your own experience, especially on the places in you where you know you might be stuck a little bit, then you can hear those stuck places are talked about in different ways in each of the realms. And I think in terms of the Western, especially psychoanalytic, psychotherapeutic traditions, they're pretty astute when it comes to talking about some of the particular problems of each of the realms. And I think the most helpful thing, and I think you can get this from either side, from the Buddhist side or from the Western side, is that the fundamental problem of samsara is the Sanskrit name for this wheel of life where people are stuck, the fundamental problem that could be talked about as with words like estrangement or dissociation, that no one is experiencing who they are or where they are, which realm they're in. No one is experiencing it without a little bit of fear, you know, without a little bit of distancing, without pushing away some aspect of their experience a little bit, so that things are scarier, things are more anxiety-making, things are more difficult than they have to be when you are able to shift your perspective enough so that you're not fighting with whatever the experience is. And that's a lot of what we're practicing when we practice meditation, which we'll do together. That's a lot of what we're practicing, just sitting here doing nothing, watching the breath, or listening to the sounds, or feeling your body. What you start to notice are the various ways that you're not quite there, that you're not quite doing it, that for some reason you're just like a little bit at odds with your experience. And gradually, in meditation, it takes a long time, but gradually you learn how to sit back a little bit into your own experience, even uncomfortable aspects of your experience. And when you're able to do that, those uncomfortable aspects actually become the way that you deepen your practice. So another sort of take-home message from all of this is this idea that the way out is through. You know, the way out, the way off the wheel, the way out of any place that you might be stuck is by going deeper into the experience. The animal realm is the realm of instinctual gratification. It's the realm of like hunger and sex and so on. It's the realm that Freud spent a great deal of time unpacking. Freud had amazing insights into people get stuck in the animal realm. I think I have one good thing I wanted to read to you from Freud, if you can stand to listen to Freud. He's actually a great writer. This is Freud. What we call happiness, in the strict sense, comes from the preferably sudden satisfaction of needs which have been dammed up to a high degree. And it is from its nature only possible as a periodic phenomenon. So he's basically talking about orgasm here as the ultimate joyful experience. But he's using this 19th century language of physics, which he sort of liked. The satisfaction of needs which have been dammed up to a high degree, and it is from its nature only possible as a periodic phenomenon. When any situation that is desired by the pleasure principle is prolonged, it only produces a feeling of mild contentment. We are so made that we can derive intense enjoyment only from a contrast and very little from a state of things. Thus, our possibilities of happiness are already restricted by our constitution. So that's interesting on a couple of levels. From the meditative point of view, there are states of sublime bliss and happiness that can be maintained for long periods of time. So he's not exactly right about that, because he read like early translations of Sanskrit scholars who brought stuff back to Germany, but didn't quite understand it. But even those states of prolonged bliss, those go in the God realm, but even those are temporary. They could last for eons, but they're still temporary. But what Freud's talking about relates more to the animal realm and to the human realm, and to addiction, which has brought a lot of you here. And I think what you find often in addiction is the first pleasure, the first time that you're drunk, the first time that you take a drug, relief that it brings, and the happiness that it brings, the joy, the pleasure that it brings, is like the best thing that you've ever had, and then it's never quite that good again. And there's this urge inside to try to reproduce that original experience, Freud's getting at that right away here, that we're so made that the intense pleasure that we're seeking, we can't make it last. So the addiction is right away, you're like chasing the tail of this thing that it just physiologically it's not really possible. That's how people die from heroin, because they just keep pushing it up and up. Inset into each realm is a little tiny figure of the Bodhisattva of wisdom. I think it's Manjushri, right?
Inside each one?
Inside each one.
Well, it's the Buddha, actually.
Is it the Buddha?
Yeah. I will look at this for the Buddha of compassion.
Okay.
And manifesting in such a way that the beings in that realm will perceive them as a Buddha.
Okay. So, and it's in the mandalas, it's painted in, and in each realm they're holding a different instrument, meant to show what's necessary to change the perspective in that realm. So in the animal realm, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, Avalokiteshvara, is holding a book. Because what's necessary for the taming of the instincts is knowledge, self-knowledge.
I think you have the book in the human realm, I think.
No, in the human realm is the Buddha himself, in his robe and... at least in the, I'm sure it's different.
Okay, where was the book in which house?
The book's in the animal realm.
Oh.
According to my sources.
There might be a version like that.
There
a reading animal.
In the hell realms.
Or maybe you could say they put it in that painting to indicate that the animal, would be better off to become human, but they could use the book.
Exactly.
So it's like bringing them to where they have the language. Because the animals don't have the language, because their suffering is described as anyunya bhakshana, one eating each another.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all devouring each other, so they have no time to chat.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm behind someone getting you. So that so the book might be encouraging them to think about it instead.
Yeah.
Dr. Thane.
Yeah.
In that particular painting.
Yeah. Because in fact, some animals do have language.
What?
Some animals, it turns out, do have language and are already writing.
Well, of course they have language, but
yeah.
But they don't read.
They don't read.
Without a thinker.
No, not yet.
Although actually there are Sthiramati, there's a story, the great Indian master Sthiramati.
Mm-hmm.
It is said that he was a parrot in a previous life, not very long before his life, who would belong to Vasubandhu. And Vasubandhu was a Theravadin, a great scholar, and his brother Asanga was a Mahayanist. And Asanga gave him this huge load of books that Asama had written, and then all the Mahayana sutras at that time, what they had. And he said, "As my brother," because they're into like brotherly piety, you know, in India at that time. So then Vasubandhu, he got himself in a bath of warm sesame oil, where he would spend the day and read all these books. And the he read them aloud, and the parrot would listen. And then the parrot was immediately reborn as a human and became a great professor. in India in the fourth, fifth century, they say. And there is a story like that. So maybe that's it. He was the one that was holding the book, you know,
and
the parrot.
And they have a treatment at the spa over here where you two can sit in warm sesame oil.
I don't know if they have the whole bath, I think so. Just rub down it. Because he had to get into sesame oil because it made him so nervous to read all these many books.
Yeah.
That Asanga made him read.
Yeah.
He said, "Asanga has sent me an elephant load of books, my elder brother, and I have to read them all now." So he had to get in the path to calm his anxiety. I'm sorry.
Good. Okay, so that's the animal realm.
Yeah.
So the hell realm, the Buddha figure holds a mirror. Because the thing about the hell realms is that people feel, and we know this when we're, at its most extreme in our world, it becomes paranoia, you know, when people can't handle the intensity of their own rage, they start to project it outwards and begin to experience other people as hating them the way they can't quite acknowledge that they themselves are hating. And that mechanism, that defense mechanism, basically of projection, takes place on a milder level in everyday, not crazy people. It's in its most intense form, you know, then you're completely taken over in one way or another. But the Buddha figure here holds up a mirror so that the hell beings themselves, when confronted with the mirror, can see that the pain that they're believing themselves to be in are actually their own emotions. So, and that again, you get this sense of estrangement from the self, which is underlying all of these emotional states. The hungry ghost realm is one of the ones that I'm most interested in, both from my own experience, which I've written about, and which when we have time tomorrow I can talk more about, and also from a lot of my patients. The idea in the hungry ghost realm is that there are these beings who are described, the anatomy is described beautifully, with long, very, very thin necks, and so thin that even swallowing a bit of water burns, because it's like one cell, that kind of thing. And big bloated bellies, so empty bellies, beings who are craving nourishment, filled with a sense of inexhaustible loneliness or emptiness. But they're so frail, their anatomy is such that they can't really take in any present day nourishment. So there's a ghost-like feeling to the hungry ghosts.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but
go ahead.
They're not ghosts, they are actually born beings.
Yes.
And that hungry ghost translation came from through the Chinese, the way the Chinese translated it, and then it got kind of stuck in Western language.
Interesting.
Because the preta is the word, right? Preta.
Yeah.
And it isn't a ghost, it's a kind of animal, and that's between hell and the animal.
Yeah.
Right? And especially the characteristic is frustration and starvation.
Yeah.
And thirst comes. But it isn't, the ghost makes it sound like, unfortunately, like some sort of being that could be dealt with more easily because you sort of exorcise the ghost, yeah. Get them to be reborn somewhere. But it just got from Chinese.
The only reason I like the ghost part, and I get that it's not originally there, but from a psychological point of view, we see this in therapy all the time. People who are looking backwards into the past, trying to get some deprivation, some abandonment that they've experienced.
Well, you can try that.
That's the only reason that I mean,
the point is, in the Buddhist cosmology, there are actual ghosts who are stuck in a life that they died from, and something, either hatred or some intense emotion, or the people they're still engaged with, or the objects they're engaged with, then they stay in the between state, constantly dying, being reborn, and then they are, but they might not be hungry.
They might not be pregnant.
But they don't have stomachs. You know, they're like subtle body beings, like a dream being.
Yeah.
But they're just obsessed with some situation in the life they left.
Mm-hmm.
And they are such beings, according to them. And the Chinese sort of mixed that with the idea of a preta.
Mm-hmm.
That's my point. But the preta, the problem with the preta, is the person is born there and stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not looking on at the human life, they're just really starving. They don't even remember the human life. And then, you know, the three poisons, those three realms below the human, the animal is from excessive stupidity or delusion, the preta is from excessive lust and greed, and the hell is from hatred.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if a human dies with any one of those things too predominant, that's unfortunately where they go.
Right.
So that's going to happen.
Right. And that goes for just in this life too. If your mind is filled, you know, with one or the other, then that's the realm that you're mostly stuck in,
right.
Even in this world. The Buddha.
They say, by the way, that for a human to find out where they were before, if they were in one of those lower realms, is you get them drunk. And then when they're drunk, if they're greedy, they want to eat like a lot of ice cream or something, then they might have been a preta.
Uh-huh.
If they want to fight, then they came from hell.
Uh-huh.
And if they just kind of go blah, then they might have been an animal.
Interesting.
They say that's a Tibetan thing, that's a folk thing. Just get your patient nice and drunk and see what they do. And then you know how to handle it. Angela's laughing.
So the Buddha figure in the hungry ghost realm carries a bowl filled with spiritual nourishment, because it's only spiritual nourishment that can awaken the preta, which is why coming here is good. You know, if any of those qualities are there in you, then if we can convey anything worthwhile, then that sense of emptiness, that sense of too much separateness and aloneness, the people who were talking about getting into relationships with addicts and so on, often this mindset, this emotional stuff is underlying that, because you're trying to fill up something that can't really be filled by merging too much with another needy person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you read Gabor Marquez's In the Realm of the Hungry Ghosts.
I did not.
Okay, so he talks about heroin addiction in Vancouver. He talks about the Hungry Ghosts as actually really stemming from trauma. And I wonder if you see it the same way, so that they're so traumatized they can't take in any lover,
yeah.
And they can't take it in anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to try to talk about that tomorrow. There's a whole sense of developmental trauma, which is like trauma that happens early in life that we talk about in therapy a lot. And that often people who have had that experience end up emotionally in places like we're talking about here. Yes, absolutely. The God realm. You can sort of imagine the God realm is filled with beings who don't have to have bodies, or maybe they have very subtle bodies, and they can be there for very long periods of time, just sort of suspended in pleasurable feeling. There's death from the God realm when your karma runs out. your time there is gone, but there's no like getting sick like we get sick and where we have to deal with dying and so on. They just immediately plop, they're gone into the next realm. They go in an instant. The Buddha figure there is playing a lute. The lute is like the bell, which is meant to wake the god beings up from their trance-like slumber, because their time is temporary and they're not working on themselves. You know, they're too busy luxuriating in the pleasures that they've earned from wherever they were before. But at some moment, I after 9/11, I worked with a wonderful woman whose husband was in the towers and died. And he was a very wealthy banker and so on, and his office was in all the way at the top of one of the towers. And we talked a lot about how he was like in a god realm. You know, he'd been in a god realm his whole life. He had tons of money, and he had a boat and a house in the Hamptons, and he loved to shop at Hermes. And he went in an instant, but that helped her to think about it like that. It gave her a way to understand that we all die in different ways. So what else? The jealous god realm. The god realm and the jealous god realm are separated by a wishing tree, and the wishing tree grows delicious fruits so that if you can get one, then your wishes come true. So the jealous gods are fighting the gods for the fruits of the wishing tree. And that I think of this realm as like the realm of the ego, and that ego psychology and cognitive therapy and so on, all the therapies that have been developed to strengthen the ego, which is a necessary thing, are working in this realm, trying to get the jealous gods off of their competitiveness, because they're fighting over the wrong things, and they could be strengthening their own minds. And mindfulness meditation, for instance, that we've already started to talk about, that we'll do some together tomorrow, I think of really as an ego strengthening exercise. Often people think that we're just eroding the ego, we're trying to get rid of the ego, but it depends, of course, on how you understand what an ego is, which I'm not sure anybody really does, but according to Freud, anyway, the ego is that which modulates or mediates between the inner world and the outer world, between the instincts and between the demands of external reality. So you need an ego in order to function, in order to manage yourself. And one of the main things that mindfulness is good for is that it teaches you how to manage your emotional self. That's an ego function. And a very helpful one, especially for people who are struggling with all these conditions that we're talking about here, where they're kind of at the mercy of their emotional selves, whether it be addictive or anxious or depressed or anything else. And with the practice of mindfulness being an ego function, there's like strength given to this idea of self-regulation or self-modulation. And the Buddha figure here comes with a flaming sword, the sword of discriminating wisdom, which is sort of like the book in the animal realm, but it's meant to redirect the aggression from, fighting with your siblings over who's going to get the inheritance, to instead doing something, to make yourself a better person. And then the last, and I'll stop after this, the last is the human realm, which, as I mentioned before, we're lucky to be here. It's the realm of the greatest opportunity. It's where you can get enlightened from this realm. For people who are not oriented spiritually, the highest aspect of the human realm is said to be that of creative expression. So it's where the artists are. But it's really the realm of the search for the self, or the problem of the self is inherent to the human realm. So we're going to spend some time talking about the self, trying to find the creative expression. Artists are all about, most art is self-representation, even if it's abstract. Artists are all about, bringing the inside out. And we're doing some kind of, meditation is some kind of a formless art, we're using the mind, using the heart, to go inside, to investigate, and to kind of cultivate or craft a better version. I don't know, I have to watch that language now, but a more enlightened version of ourselves. So in the human realm, for me, those of you who have read my work know that I'm devoted to this one particular British child psychoanalyst named Donald Winnicott. And Winnicott writes, and I'll be talking about him tomorrow on Sunday, but Winnicott writes about the difficulty of being both a parent or a child, that a growing child has to cope with either an intrusive or abandoning parental environment, and that the self is developed out of a kind of reaction to either the intrusion or the abandonment. That the good enough mother, which is the phrase that he coined when mothers were doing all the parenting, but the good enough mother, the good enough parent, is one who gives the right kind of space. So doesn't over abandon, doesn't over intrude, and with that adequate amount of space, which, see, I think in meditation we're doing that for ourselves. We're trying to find the right kind of space to give ourselves. But the child who's given that right kind of space develops a continuity of self. And I use that phrase, going on being, for one of my books. That's a phrase from Winnicott. The child who has trouble finding that kind of space has to develop what Winnicott calls a false self, which is a self that he also calls it a caretaker self. It's a self that develops in order to handle the parental needs or the parental abandonment, you know, the space, the too much space or the too little space. So then that false self, which is like a defensive organization, doesn't feel real on the inside. So then there's a struggle that Winnicott talks about between the false self and some notion that there might be a truer version somewhere. And that can either lead someone on a spiritual search for the true self, or it can lead someone into the various places that many of you have talked about. Because a lot of what happens in substance use and abuse is people are actually trying to get rid of that sense of the false self, because it's uncomfortable. And if you're getting your patients drunk, you know, you can, when you get your patients drunk, you can find out who they were before. So it takes away, a lot of the substances take away the pressure of this defensively organized false self. The Buddha figure in the human realm comes in the form of the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, who went through a whole process of trying this, trying that, getting depressed, getting anxious, trying, you know, becoming anorectic, until he finally found what he called the middle path, which was the right amount of space for himself. And out of that, you know, he was able to find his way home. That's what we're going to talk about for the next couple of days.
Okay, a little further, you have a little, what time is it?
It's like 9:15 already.
9:15?
Yeah.
Okay, just a few minutes, because I think people will be tired.
Yeah.
I thought maybe we would start the evening on this session, coming back to it tomorrow, with two meditations, which we'll do together. And since we're in the human realm, mm-hmm. and we can think, very lucky, we will try to meditate a little bit. The first one is kind of very radical meditation on selflessness, which is and there's a special precept about it that comes from the Atisha, some Indian master, famous Indian master in the century, supposedly, but it's a personal kind of oral precept. And then although it's found in some of the writings of the Dalai Lamas. And then there is the Lama Dzongkhapa, who was a very famous one in the early 15th century. But it's sort of a personal one. And the only place it's written that I know of is in the writings of the Panchen and the Dalai Lama, who were the first one of which first Dalai Lama, both the first Pajit Lama and first Dalai Lama were students of Tsongkhapa. So go into meditative mode, we'll quickly do this together, we'll just go through it. Something called the three keys, I will talk about in terms of three keys. Usually it's four keys, we'll talk about in terms of three keys. And the most important God is the first key. So the idea in the first key of the meditation on selflessness, which is considered which is same as emptiness, like the famous emptiness, which is considered the most important meditation, because meditations of sort of calming your addictive emotions and addictive ideas, to become more, give yourself more space, not to be less sort of appetitive and to be less paranoid and aggressive. Those meditations will be very beneficial, but they will not liberate one from the core of suffering, which comes from delusion. The only thing that liberates one from delusion, which is the only thing that liberates one from suffering, is wisdom. And wisdom doesn't mean some sort of mystic sort of oneness notion. Wisdom means truly realistic experience of reality, which you are, Buddha insisted you were capable of, as I think psychotherapists insist that too, that people should be more realistic. And so the first of those four keys is very important, because the expression selflessness means that the reality, it's a kind of report, you could say a scientific report by the Buddha, that a certain kind of self is missing, is lacking in a living being, and a human being, all living beings and human being. But this particular kind of sense of self or self is assumed to be present in the being. And this is the core of the delusion. And in other words, if one thinks, that's what Mark already mentioned wonderfully, remembering the story about the Geshe Wangyal, where he said, people are not wrong thinking they exist or they're real, or even he would say that they have a self. But the problem is they think they're really real, they really exist, and they have a real self, like an absolute self. Or there's a lot of very sophisticated language in Buddhism, you know, an intrinsically real self, an intrinsically objective self, an intrinsically identifiable self is considered the most subtle level, something like an intrinsic identity, an identity that is there sort of on its own, that's independent, absolute, undeniable, you know, solid, kind of, okay? This kind of self is this kind of self that we don't have. So now, but then what does that really mean? And this is the first key of meditating on selflessness, to begin to get a bit of an experiential or visceral feeling of what is that? Okay, if according to Buddha, if I'm not enlightened, perfectly enlightened, like a Buddha, it means that I have this idea of this kind of false self. I'm not sure quite how it fits, although it's
false. It does fit. It fits.
The other kind of false self, yeah, that you mentioned. But this kind of false self. And this is therefore, the first key is identifying what this is, what it feels like, finding that I have it in my mental habit, in my sense of self, okay? And the way that you do this in this particular, as I said, personal, you know, guru to disciple tradition is you remember, you're meditating now, I hope, and you remember an event in your past, could be recent, could be far in the past, where you were an innocent of something and someone you cared about accused you of doing that something, having that something, being that something. In other words, you're in a moment, you must try to remember and I guess they consider that everyone can find such memories, where someone said, you know, you did this and so, how could you do such and such, you know? Particularly the emotionally powerful one is for someone you cared about. And they misunderstood the situation, and they thought you did something and accused you for it, and actually you didn't do it. It doesn't mean remember a situation where you were accused of something and you did do it. Because you won't get the same feeling from that, a different set of feelings. But you actually were innocent in this case. You took my something, you did my something, you said something. Try to remember some incident where someone falsely accused you. And and there's a little bit of it, even a subtlety, a nuance in this meditational remembering, which is that the rememberer should be a small portion of your consciousness energy. It should be like as if you were, you know, surreptitiously observing yourself in the event that you remember, so that your main consciousness tries to relive the memory. So you try to remember this incident with where you relive it, if possible. Which is possible, but whether you can do it in some quick way, I don't know. They say take plenty of time. Normally, we don't have that much this evening, we're just introducing it. And this, if you think about it, if you find an incident like that, and if the person, you protest your innocence, from the feeling that you're looking for, you would then maybe rise in protest that I didn't, I'm innocent, I didn't do that. What are you talking about? I didn't do that. I was have an alibi or whatever. You know, and this is the feeling you had from which you spoke out protesting your innocence. And it's the feeling prior to another kind of feeling might have happened where you became indignant that the person thought that you had done this, and sort of then righteous and then angry might be sort of a sequence, a pretty normal habitual sequence. And what you want is the first feeling of injured innocence before you rise in indignant protest, if possible. You want to find that in a memory, then you want to really drill down into it and relive it. And you don't want to be thinking that, well, I'm looking at now a sense of self, a sensed self that feels undeniably innocent and is therefore very, very present. You don't want to be doing, I'm doing that in order to find out that it isn't there. You sort of bracket the next step, in other words, following steps. You want to feel as strongly as you can and as clearly as you can how much you really feel. There is that self there that's really innocent, that's really, you know, being hurt feelings, that's really falsely accused and really purely innocent. And because of the innocence, it sort of comes out in your awareness strongly. So that when you do then rise to protest, I did not do that, the sense of the I really seems to rise out of your heart, out of your gut, like from something solid in your heart and gut. Try this, try to do this now. Find the memory, dwell in the memory. Only observe yourself from a little corner of the present. and really get into the path memory. They say that when you know that you have achieved this key point, key insight, you feel so strongly your sense of inner presence, of your identity, your real self, your innocent self, that you are surprised that but you accept yourself, that you actually don't agree that you lack such a self. In other words, if Buddha walked in and said, oh, you don't have a real solid self in there, and if there's no core in your heart, in your being, you would feel not easy agreement, you would feel disagreement and challenge by that statement, selflessness. And when you realize that you have here a confrontation, if you will, with the teaching of selflessness and how you actually feel, that's when you have, you know, sort of achieved the first key, they say. And therefore, it takes time, because you know when you're meditating, this start with, and you're in the context of the Buddha's teaching, and you sort of are kind of inclined to try to experimentally go along. But that would be a mistake according to this precept, because if you thought the object of your inner inquiry, your inner mindfulness, and by the way, the word we translate as mindfulness is only exactly the word in Pali or Sanskrit or Tibetan that means memory, actually. So it is the same thing. It's remembering something internal. So if you think that the object of the meditation on selflessness sounds like the object is selflessness, but actually the object is the self. And you can't really go looking for the self unless you strongly feel there's something to look for. You know what the term refers to. And so you want to find the referent in your inner experience, habitual, conditioned inner experience, inner cognitive field, you want to find what is referred to by I, pronoun self. Freud would have used the pronoun ich, not the Greek ego, the German ich. The pronoun. So the meditation on selflessness, in other words, of which this is the first step in this system, in this tradition, is the identification of the self that we sense within ourselves. What Buddha would call the exaggerated intrinsic self that we feel is there, the really real one. We have to feel how we really do feel, we have to admit that we do feel that, and feel how it feels when it kind of comes most out to us, when we feel righteously innocent. And then, therefore, the quest of the reality of that situation is a inquiry where, in a way, one accepts the Buddha's challenge, the Buddhist psychologist's challenge, which is, okay, I acknowledge you feel that. You acknowledge to yourself you feel that way. I'm not telling you you shouldn't feel that way, just like an ethical thing, moral thing, or some kind of authority thing, that I know you don't have it or something, so you shouldn't feel that way. I'm not telling you that. I'm telling you that you have to start with the fact that you do feel that way. But maybe my challenge to you is, would you verify that? Would you care to really investigate and see if you really do find that self when you really look for it? If you don't, please let me know. If you do, please let me know. Maybe my selflessness thing is itself an exaggeration. Maybe Buddha was in a bad mood. So it's an open question. Because you feel it's really there. Buddha says it isn't really there. So you have to struggle with that. And the second key is that looking for that self, you will either find it and verify it and say, okay, here, this is it. I feel it when I'm in certain emotions and moods, and this, now I've found it. Or I won't find it. And I commit to my, you know, conventional awareness, practical awareness, that, you know, things are just either there or not there in the practical, in the surface world, okay, where I live, relative world. It's either, you know, I look for an elephant in the room, it's either here or it isn't here. There's no sort of third option where it's sort of, its ghost is here or micro elephant's here or some kind of mystical thing. Practically speaking, this self that I feel is there in my gut, in my heart, in my solar plexus. Either I'll really find it there, or I won't. And I commit to that outcome, to the exhaustiveness of those outcomes, before I kind of dive into my mindfulness and then my inquiry into myself, the status of myself. And the need for that is that when we do concentrate, focus, starting with mindfulness and going to more kind of one-pointed inquiry, you know, vipassana, samadhi, combining it more with sort of concentration, you can get lost in there. You are so complicated. We are, the living being, the human being is so complicated. So we want to have a practical outcome. Just like it's very practical that I feel I'm really here and I don't agree, that I lack a real Bobhood, Bob self in here, is what Buddha says. Not Arjuna says, Buddha psychology says. Then the third key is, when we do it in a three-key way, not a four-key, a five-key. The third key is to look within the body-mind complex, the physical processes of the body, and the mental processes of sensations, recognitions, emotions, and consciousnesses, the complexity of the being when one mindfully investigates the inner field of awareness, awarenesses, you know, complex inner field of awarenesses. And one is guided by, when there's only three keys, one is guided by what is called the key reason, called the royal reason of relativity. The self that I feel when I feel righteously innocent seems like absolute to me. And in that, and that's the best moment to observe it, when I have injured innocence. In a way, without having to remember, I can remember times I was furiously angry. And I was acting, I'm driven by that anger, I was acting out anger. And when I was doing that, when I look back at myself, I realized I was behaving like I was absolute. The anger gripped me so completely, I had lost all restraint. I said things I didn't mean, I did destructive things I didn't, well, regretted doing immediately, but because I was like out of relationship with a thing, people and things around me, I broke things I valued. I broke relationships I cherished. So I was like bull in a china shop. It was like that emotion gripped me and whipped me into action from a seemingly absolute place. But that's not necessarily the best thing to remember, because in those moments, you can't really remember the self, because you're kind of unconscious. If you go into drilling down in that moment, it will not be as fruitful as if you drill down in the moment where you first felt this injury of the false accusation and you were simply hurt before you exploded in some way or became indignant and angry and protesting and so on. But the reason of relativity is that since my inquiring consciousness, when I look inside, just like when I look outside and see flowers and trees and everything, is relative. I see something because I relate to it visually. I hear something because I relate to it audibly. I smell because I relate to it, the smell, olfactorily. I taste and touch things, relating to them. I mentally imagine something, or I mentally perceive something, or think something. I'm relating to those thoughts. I mentally have an image of something, I relate to the image. I mentally feel something, I relate to the feeling. The royal reason of relativity is, if I can relate to it, it's relative. If it's absolute, it cannot be related to. So even if I feel something as an absolute, feeling it relativizes it. Is the third key. So in a way, the first key is where I recognize that I do absolutize my sense of self, or I have a sense that there's an absolutized self there, and I have to go all the way to where I really feel that. Then I accept a challenge and I look at it, and then whatever, if I find an aspect, it's relational. So I have to look deeper, and I have to look deeper, and I have to look deeper. Because I'm still feeling that beyond what I'm relating to, there's a real solid thing behind it. Do you follow? And I remember that I felt that when I did the first key. So then this puts me in a deep, inner, kind of dervish spinning of inquiry, looking for this solid object in there, in that consciousness that's looking, actually, as well. But that's when we develop it further. Okay, ding, that's enough because of the time. We can't go further with that. I'm just giving you the area because I wanted to inform our discussion.
This podcast was made possible through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership and listeners like you. If you're inspired by what you hear in these weekly podcasts, be sure to like and share on your favorite social media platform. And when in New York City, be sure to visit Tibet House US. And when in upstate New York, visit its retreat center, Menla Mountain, located in Phoenicia, New York. Podcast music provided weekly by Tenzin Chogyal. All rights reserved.